This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
As far as the Reformed doctrine of Christ, extra-Calvinisticum, this was a Lutheran protest against the Calvinists, but they could also say the Roman Catholics. At this point, the traditional Roman Catholic theology is exactly the same as Calvin. You'd say the Calvinists is exactly the same as Roman Catholic to get it more accurate. Or at that point, the Eastern Orthodox as well. It's a teaching of the so-called extra-Calvinisticum. That means Calvinistic extra. That had been taught long before by Athanasius, Hilary, and Augustine, and Thomas Aquinas, and the others. But Calvin formulated it very clearly, as you'll see at the bottom of 52 and top of 53. Formulates it very clearly, but I mean, he leaves the mystery of which there's no explanation. In 2.13.4, Institutes 2.13.4. Although the boundless essence of the Word was united with human nature, nevertheless, we do not imagine there to be any enclosing of the Logos in it. The Son of God descended miraculously from heaven, says Calvin, following Aquinas and Athanasius, the rest. Yet without abandoning heaven, he was pleased to be conceived miraculously in the Virgin's womb, to live on earth, to hang on the cross in such a way that he always filled the world as from the beginning. You know, John 1:18, he that is in the bosom of the Father, yet he's down on earth, he hath made him known. Because he is God. Now, the main point here, I would like you to read. I want you to know that that's what the extra-Calvinisticum is. I want you to read these two pages, 53 and 54. And basically, the question that is that we're trying to deal with is the limitations of our human mind and understanding space as space relates to God. The best work up to this point that I know of done on the issue was T.F. Torrance, Space, Time, and Incarnation, less than 100 pages done, 1969, Oxford University Press, and received many, many prizes. And after that time, he was asked to speak to conferences of scientists. His health is not good now, so he can't now, but up until 3 years ago, all the leading physics conferences were having him on a fairly regular basis. And Torrance thinks through, and it's hard reading, Space, Time, and Incarnation. I think it's 96 pages. But what if I could just summarize it, and then I hope some of you that may have a scientific interest will have the initiative to read it yourself, and any, by the way, any of you that read it that would like to sit down and discuss it with me, I'll be glad to do it. It doesn't mean I would be able to answer all your questions, but I'd certainly be happy to talk about it with you. It's basically bringing out how the Greek fathers, Athanasius and Cyril of Alexandria, and Gregor Nazianzus and others, and then in the West, particularly St. Hilary of Poitiers, realized that you cannot say that God is spatially related to space. Why? Why'd there be a problem with that? Anybody? Yeah, confined. And then he's part of the thing. Rather, God's relationship to space is in terms of power. creative, omnipotent, controlling power. Hence, when Christ remains God while taking on our humanity in the womb of the Blessed Virgin and being born and so forth, he still retains his godness and his relationship to space in terms of power. So therefore, Torrance brings out in not only that book but others, he's worked on after that for years, on how Christianity, particularly through the great physicist John Philoponus, whom I can't say I really understand very much of Philoponus, is certainly not of his work in physics. I get a little, read a little in theology, but I'm not competent to get what he's doing in physics very much. But there was a reconstruction of a whole worldview in terms of who God is. He's related to space in terms of power, not space itself. He is not enclosed. Hence, Christ truly takes on the body, and yet his deity is not enclosed by it. So then, I think if you just read this page 53 and 4, you will get some a little help on it, maybe. Now, page 56, I want you to have some idea of what is meant by communication of properties. Communicatio idiomatum is the Latin term. And I'd like you to be, at least have a general awareness of what that is. And by the way, in your readings in John Calvin, particularly book 2, the sections you read on Christology, he has some very good things to say about the communication of idioms, or the communicatio idiomatum. Idioms means the characteristics of the nature. Characteristics of, or the attributes of the divinity. Characteristics, or the attributes of the deity. And the Reformed theologians worked that out based on what the Catholic fathers had said all the way through. They Reformed take it a little more, maybe lay it out a little more academically. Communication of graces, and then particularly the communication of idioms. That is to say, each nature does what is proper to it. And what is proper to one nature is not directly attributed to the other nature, but to the person. So the attributes of the humanity are attributed directly to the person. The attributes of the deity are attributed directly to the person, but not to the nature, because one doesn't, the nature of the humanity is not swallowed up or transmuted into divinity, nor is the divinity swallowed up or shrunk down into the humanity. So communication of idioms is a way of helping us understand that each nature does what is proper to itself in direct communication with the person. The communication of operations, I'm not going to worry you with that. But turn to 59D, the doctrine of an hypostasia or an hypostasis and in hypostasis. I do wish you to at least be roughly familiar with what that means. And this is, you know, the fathers of the church worked on this, as did a number of the 17th century Calvinistic Reformed persons that you would find in Heppe's famous book, Reformed Dogmatics. Heppe, Heinrich Heppe, H-E-P-P-E, that's referenced here. It's a good book if you can get it. It's still in print, I assume. And Heppe goes through various topics or headings of the great continental Reformed thinkers and says what each one said on Christ, deity, on his salvation, on man's sin, on the end of time and all. It's a very good reference. It was done in the 19th century. I use it frequently in my teaching. And in Heppe, you can look up anhypostasia or anhypostasis and in hypostasis. And at this point, I reference him, Karl Barth's done some helpful historical work in the small print in some of his volumes. I believe, well, I seem like particularly 2-1, but I'm not sure. Anyway, let me just give you in my words what is anhypostasis and in hypostasis. And that's what I'll test you on, just the basic understanding. All the extra you can read is good. But what I hold you responsible for, as I say, is what we do together. Let's, for instance, turn to page 61. And I want you to read, I'm going to tell you in my words, as I say, but I want you to be sure you read B, 61B, in the Doctrine of the Anhypostasia. Okay? So mark that, be sure you read it. But look at me and let me tell you. Just kind of boil it down to the point. The humanity of Christ, did it have a beginning or not? Yeah. Did his deity have a beginning? No. When did the humanity then take its origin? Or whence? When did it have its beginning? Conception. So, it would be correct to say, wouldn't it, that the humanity of our Lord was not existing before the miraculous conception, right? That is certainly right. Anhypostasia, an means non. You know, this alpha privative thing, except the new is because it's in front of a rough breathing. Upsilon, rough breathing. Anhypostasia. It's saying non-personal. Now, that has been seriously misunderstood by some, surprisingly, guys in the 19th century and some in the 20th that I would have thought, particularly some of the Protestants, that I would have thought were better educated, completely misunderstood it. And they said, well, then the ancient church, the Catholics and the Calvinists together are affirming that Christ was non-personal. That's ridiculous. That's not what it's saying at all. I don't know. Sometimes books get published and guys even in high positions that may be good in many other areas get something totally wrong. It doesn't mean, it's not affirming the impersonality of Christ's humanity. It's only saying the humanity of our Lord had no independent antecedent personal existence before the miraculous conception in the womb of the Virgin. That his humanity only begins to be through the action of God as the shadow of the Most High comes over chosen virgin. In other words, this cuts out all kind of adoptionism. What was a historical adoptionism? Who can tell me? Right. And there's a kind of adoptionism in Protestant modernism. the idea Christ was the best. You know, he's the... I understand. I've been to the outside, never the inside of the Riverside Church in New York. That aren't there statues? Some of you have been there. Is it correct? One of my professors told me many years ago, the statue of Christ, the greatest teacher, a statue of Christ, the great physician, the greatest physician, a statue of Christ, the greatest ethicist, and all that. Is there any of you been in that church? Let's see. Kind of the bastion of Protestant modernism in the, you know, 30s and 40s. So the idea was that Christ is the greatest man in all these different areas. And that's what he is. That's who he is. He is the one we should emulate. What is left unsaid? He's not God. He would only be divine in the sense. And some of the modernists, some of them wouldn't have gone this far. There'd be a few that would have gone as far as to say, there is a certain deity about this man Jesus because he did so well. He had such a God consciousness as, you know, Schleiermacher's idea of his dependence on God that he was kind of adopted into a certain situation higher than the rest of us, and we could maybe aspire to that. That is not what the New Testament is teaching at all. The humanity, it was not an independent man with a personality that comes into union. There was no personality and hypostasia. But the human nature comes into existence in intimate union with the Logos, the second person of the Trinity. Now, with that, and this is where some of Barth's work is good, particularly as I say in Barth, you got in the small print some remarkable, I mean, it can be at times very one-sided, but also very good, some remarkable historical theological material tracing all this out, and particularly with Barth, where he draws together the inhypostasia with the anhypostasia. The anhypostasia, no independent existing personality, but the inhypostasia means his human personality is established, and the in is this. In Greek, means in the person of the Logos. He does have genuine human emotions and the attributes of what it is to be a human person. You're finding that in Jesus of Nazareth all the way through. But that personhood is established in the person of God the Son of the Logos. Again, none of these people would have been so terrible or so deluded as to think they knew how it worked. They didn't know how it worked. The Bible didn't tell them how it worked. The councils of the historic church didn't tell them how it worked. It didn't know. What we can say is when you respect the mystery and say you don't transgress, on the alpha privatives, either in the Alexandrian way, the Antiochene way, or the independent existing personality, or saying he's non-personal, what have you, try to hold that together. You will come close to having the New Testament portrait of Christ, and through that the Spirit works in salvation and carries on the church, you know, until the very end. Let me say one other word here before we going to, I'm going to take some questions in a minute, but I want to get ready to go to the states of Christ in just a moment. One other word about the Second Council of Constantinople. I don't remember where that is, but all I want you to know is this. The Second Council of Constantinople, in here somewhere. AD 680. Just write it down. You can look it up and find it. AD 680 was condemning the monothelites. Again, there's a point to it. You might say, oh, me. Why did they have to do that or something, you know, and something else to learn, but wait a minute. Okay. Monothelites. Mono. And then we'll put. Who can tell me in Greek what is thelema? Will. Okay. Obviously, you know what mono is. One will. So the monothelites, and I could give you a lot more details easily, but I don't want to. The monothelites were a group that basically were denying that Christ could have been tempted. That's not worthy of him. So all he had was a divine will. Therefore, the temptations weren't even real. And so the church condemns that and says, no. There's a sense in which he has a human will. He feels the deepest part of his being, these temptations. And it is in precisely in his, you know, he was tempted in every way like as we are, yet what? Without sin. It's like Adam was tempted and fell. And Christ in the wilderness, beginning of his ministry, it's like he's reliving the Adamic temptations or the temptations that Israel went through in the wilderness and failed. And Christ feeling the struggle, it's like he's turning our humanity round, bringing it back to God. It's what the Westminster Confession calls, we're going to look at it later weeks, his active obedience for us. He is turning our humanity round, saying, thy will be done. And so naturally he has what we would call a human will. And I must say, it's not something you might say, well, that's old stuff, 680 or something. I don't know. I was at a church on Wednesday night. It was not in Charlotte, somewhere else. And a young man, I'm sure he was a Christian, had seminary graduate, not of this one, but I'm sure there's not a thing wrong with the seminary which he went to. But anyway, he'd been asked to speak, and he took the subject, which I thought was ill-advised, but anyway, it's his business. He could have handled it well, except he shouldn't use his title. Wednesday night prayer meeting, ordinary folks, he entitled his prayer meeting sermon, The Impeccability of Christ. Well, I mean, don't, on prayer meeting, don't use titles like that. Okay, still he could have, no, it's the sinlessness of Christ. Well, a valid topic. But the more he talked, the worse it got. He said, it was like these so-called temptations of Christ weren't real to him. It was just like if a bird came and, I don't know if you use the exact expression, but close to it, came and pecked on a brick wall. Peck, peck, didn't make any impact. And I was getting very unhappy. And I have hardly ever publicly called down a minister or this guy wasn't ordained, but anyway, the person that's speaking in the name of God at a church, but I literally, he stopped and said, we'll take prayer requests. And I had to say, I got something to talk about before you take any prayer requests. And anyway, oh, yeah. He sure did. but I tried to do it respectfully and kindly, as I would like to be treated if I got off the rails. I mean, I certainly tried to show him as much respect as I could, but I had to intervene. Wouldn't you have? Hope you would. If you hear open, serious heresy, even if the person means well, in that case, it is necessary to intervene, as I had to sometimes when I was in the seminary. And I was very careful and very respectful, and I didn't do it much. But I had to have a clear conscience that at least I'd done what I could.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.